Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where we managed to get two Victorians to Sydney to talk about the issue of the carbon tax in regional Australia. So in order, we have Richard Miles is going to lead off. Richard Miles studied law and science at Melbourne University. He worked briefly as a lawyer, then in the trade union movement, finishing up in a senior role in the ACTU. He's been the member for Corio since 2007, a parliamentary secretary since 2009, and he's currently parliamentary secretary for Pacific Island Affairs. And Sophie Mirabella, educated in law and economics at Melbourne University, practices a lawyer, member for INDI since 2001, had various shadow ministerial positions in opposition, and is currently the Shadow Minister for Innovation, Industry, Science and Research. As many of you will know, Mr. Miles has his electorate in Geelong in regional Victoria, and Ms. Mirabella has her electorate in Wangaratta in regional Victoria. And so tonight's discussion, it's not a formal debate, it's a discussion. We'll have two speakers speaking for about 20-25 minutes each, then we'll have questions and discussion and finish no later than 7 o'clock. And the topic is the carbon tax in regional Australia. Richard Miles, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jared, for the introduction. And in talking about the carbon tax in regional Australia, I thought I would start by talking about that part of regional Australia where I hail from. Of course, Geelong, which, as I'm sure you're all aware, is about an hour southwest of Melbourne. It's had many identities in its life. A trivia question about Geelong is it was first proclaimed by an act of the New South Wales Parliament, because it was, of course, then part of New South Wales. But it nowadays has an economy which retains a lot of a manufacturing base, servicing Melbourne and a large part of southeastern Australia. It's increasingly becoming a lifestyle city. People are choosing to live in Geelong with its proximity to the Surf Coast and a more country lifestyle and commute to Melbourne. And it's also becoming something of a transport hub with Avalon Airport, Melbourne's second airport, the Port of Geelong, and a lot of land accessing both of those facilities. And I guess those last two issues means that it's also tourism is a large part of Geelong's future. It is the gateway to the Great Ocean Road, which is really the major tourist attraction in Victoria. We love our footy team. Like Sydney, we have our issues with Melbourne, only for us it's a whole lot more personal. Melbourne, we were meant to be the capital of Victoria, but some Melbourne shysters in the 19th century dodged up a map, which meant that we weren't, but that is another topic which the Sydney Institute should take up. But I think relevantly for tonight, Geelong is a place which is very much on the front line of the debate around carbon and public policy responses to carbon. Geelong arguably is one of, if not the most, carbon intensive city in Australia, with an oil refinery, an aluminium smelter, a car plant, cement works, fertiliser plant, abattoirs and many other manufacturing sites. It has three major international brands which operate out of Geelong: Shell with its oil refinery, Alcoa with its aluminium smelter, and Ford with its car plant. And so if you talk about public policy which puts a price on carbon, that is going to be an issue which is keenly followed in a place like Geelong. And yet at the same time, Geelong is also a place which is on the other side of the climate change debate as well. We live in a part of Australia where the predictions suggest that there will be less rainfall going forward. And we live in a part of Australia which is more water stressed than Melbourne, for example. My son, my eldest son, who's about 14, has lived most of his life in a world of water restrictions. And Geelong is also something of an agricultural hub, Pivot, which is a fertiliser manufacturer, and has been manufacturing in Geelong since the 1920s. 2 years ago, closed up shop, not because of the global economic crisis, but because at the height of the drought, agricultural production had gone down and there simply wasn't demand for the product that it had been making and producing in Geelong for, at that point, 80 years. The good news story there is that with the rain coming, Pivot has recommenced its operations in the last few months. And we're also a seaside town where the coastline forms a large part of our existence. If there were increases in the levels of, in sea levels, Shell, for example, would rapidly go underwater as it is basically at sea level. And of course, as I mentioned, our major tourist attraction being the Great Ocean Road is a tourist attraction which is defined by the current configuration of our coast. And so on both ends of the equation, the whole debate around climate change is intensely felt in Geelong. It is understood to be a very hard issue which needs some hard thinking. And in that sense, what Geelong, and I think Australia, does not need is for one half of the political spectrum to go missing in this equation, which in my view is what the Liberal Party has done. Having a head in the sand approach to what is a profoundly difficult issue for Geelong and for the country will not save a single job in Geelong or in Australia. Now, at the foundation of all of this, of course, is the climate science, and it still amazes me that today we find ourselves in a position of needing to defend and explain the climate science. Indeed, last night I was at a gathering of Geelong accountants where, you know, I met a person there who was vociferously arguing about the fact that there was no that the climate science was simply wrong and that there was no climate change going on at all. And I would suggest that that attitude is being fuelled by the current attitude of the opposition in the scaremongering campaign that they're engaging in and in the dog whistling that they are doing to people who want to believe that there is nothing going on with our climate. We didn't see for the first time that the Earth was round until we went into space. But for hundreds of years prior to that, the science made it clear that the Earth was round. And really, to be in a position now where you seek to deny the need for action in relation to climate change is a little akin to people in those times declaring that the Earth remains flat. In essence, the climate science, to me, is reasonably simple. And there are three propositions which actually are not contested by scientists at all. The first is that right now we have unprecedented levels of carbon dioxide within our atmosphere and that we are putting unprecedented levels of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere. Right now the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is about 390 parts per million. In the 1830s, prior to the Industrial Revolution, that figure was around 280 parts per million. Ice core samples, which can be readily tested, which take that timeline back 800,000 years, indicate that during that time frame, the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere have varied between about 180 and 300 parts per million. And so we know that at least over that time frame, we have an unprecedented situation, and that is the level, the concentration of CO2 within our atmosphere. That's the first thing, and it's not really a fact which is contested by anyone. The second is that because of that fact, scientists have been out there modelling really for the last 30 years what that means. What does it mean that we've got an unprecedented level of CO2 within our atmosphere? And the preponderance of those models show that it will likely give rise to climate change, to an increase in temperatures, to a rising of sea levels. That is the preponderance of the models is, again, not something which is contested. there will be people who have, you know, models which are the exception rather than the majority, who say my model doesn't show that. But the fact that the majority of models are showing that, again, is not a contested proposition. And the third thing is that we are now experiencing and actually observing phenomena which are consistent with those models. We have just lived through the hottest decade on record. And so when you put those three things together, in a sense, to me, the question is answered. But there are many false questions which are put forward in the context of this debate. People say, well, haven't over the last 800,000 years we seen global temperatures rise and fall? And of course the answer to that question is yes, but we have never seen the level of CO2 at the level at which it's at the moment. People say, well, can we say with certainty that temperatures are going to rise as these models show? Well, the answer is they're models, and so you can't say that with certainty. Can we say with certainty that Hurricane Katrina is a function of climate change or that the Queensland floods are the same? And of course the answer to that question is no, you can't say any of that with certainty. And is it possible that climate change won't happen to the degree that is predicted? Yes, of course that is possible. All these are the wrong questions, but they are fertile questions for climate change deniers. There is one key question that we need to be asking from the point of view of making public policy, and that is a question based around the precautionary principle. And it's simply this: are we facing today a substantial risk that our current behaviour in terms of the way in which we're putting CO2 into the atmosphere will cause catastrophic change in climate? Are we facing a substantial risk? We certainly are. It doesn't mean it's going to happen, but it certainly means we're facing a substantial risk. And given the precautionary principle, that is enough to answer that question, which is enough to demand action. Certainly in my role as the Parliamentary Secretary for Pacific Island Affairs, there is no question as to the response to the precautionary principle out there. If you live on a coral atoll, which is 1 or 2 metres above sea level, and that is your entire country, it certainly focuses the mind about the effects of rising sea levels. But also, it's very clear that if you look at the major companies that are involved in Geelong, that the companies which in a sense need to deal with any changes in public policy, they too are in no doubt about the existence of climate change. Shell says, and I'm quoting, Shell shares the widespread concern that the emission of greenhouse gases such as CO2 from human activities is contributing to global climate change. Alcoa says, Alcoa supports an economy-wide response to the challenge of climate change. And Ford says, at Ford we acknowledge the science of climate change. The company is investing a significant share of its annual $5 billion-plus global R&D budget in seeking to be a part of the solution. But far and away the most remarkable statement, I think, from that quarter about what we face comes from Shell. And it was in a booklet published this year, part of the Shell Energy Scenarios 2050 series, a booklet entitled Signals and Signposts, where it says, and I quote, the majority scientific view is becoming increasingly pessimistic about the potentially devastating effects of climate change from greenhouse gases. This is Shell speaking. The climate change crisis is far from over. Society continues to face the dilemma that a failure to reduce emissions now will mean considerably greater cost in the future, but concerted global action is still too far off given the extreme urgency required. That is Shell, the Shell oil company, who is making that statement. And so one thing is completely clear in the context of Geelong, and that is that the big industrial players absolutely get what's going on. And they talk to their workforces, and their workforces too understand what's going on and understand the threats that are involved in this. Now, the existence of the climate science is obviously the main rationale for action on the part of government. It is about, in part, Australia playing its role in a global context in literally the saving of the planet. The rationale around the climate science is the fundamental basis which led to Kyoto, which led to Copenhagen, which led to Cancun. It's led to the actions of the EU, and it's led to a significant public opinion out there in support of action around climate change. And of course, that public opinion is going to vary in its precise number from day to day, and literally it can vary as a function of the weather. Certainly public opinion was probably at its height when the drought was at its most ferocious, and that public opinion can also change significantly depending on what question is asked. But there can be no doubt that now, as compared to 10, 20 years ago, climate change is an issue which concerns the public. It has been a really significant part of the last two elections, and that sentiment is as evident in industrial Geelong as it is anywhere in Australia. But in Geelong and in Australia, there is in some ways I think now a more powerful rationale coming forward for action. Because with the rest of the world moving in relation to climate change, there is now a real risk that places like Geelong and Australia will be left behind. And the rest of the world is moving. 32 countries now have in place an emissions trading scheme. 10 US states, California, are about to introduce their emissions trading scheme from the 1st of January next year. Korea has a trial going right now. But nowhere is this action as significant and as relevant to the Australian context as what's going on today in China. China has set a target where it will reduce its emissions per unit of GDP by the year 2020 as against 2005 levels by 40 to 45%. And the Chinese hit their targets when they put in place targets such as this. They have a target of seeing non-fossil fuels make a 15% contribution to their energy resources by 2020. A target of increasing their forestation by 40 million hectares by 2020 based on 2005 levels, and they have interim targets in the lead up to 2020 to make sure that they hit all of those. China has the largest installed renewable energy electricity generation capacity in the world. There are 13 districts in China today which are trialling low-carbon pilot plans, including the examination of market mechanisms. $30 billion Australian dollars is being invested by the government there in energy-saving emission reduction programs, which in turn will generate $300 billion worth of investment in those projects. The fact is, China is moving, and with it, the world will go. And it is so important that Australia be not left behind with that movement. We currently have the highest carbon dependency of any developed country in the world, and that means that in a place like Geelong, Geelong is one of the most carbon dependent cities in the world. And if we do nothing, then we risk being saddled with a high carbon dependent economy in a world which sees this as a massive competitive disadvantage. Qantas today is being taxed 15% on its carbon emissions for flights inbound to the EU because Australia does not put a price on carbon, and it will get slugged an additional tax by the UK. That is happening right now. A failure to act will see Geelong's economy condemned. A failure to act will see, which sees Geelong fail to change in a world which is changing, and a failure of a government to facilitate companies in that change is a decision to condemn Geelong's industrial workforce. And that, more than any other issue, is what motivates me in representing the interests in Geelong. Now, once you reach the conclusion that action is required, of course, the next question is what sort of action ought to be required. And I actually think at this point you really enter the easier part of the debate. Because at least in terms of the question of what ought to be the fundamental mechanism for action, that really at the end of the day is a no-brainer. And that is to harness the power of the most significant social phenomenon that we have seen in the Western world over the last couple of hundred years, and that is the market economy. Malcolm Turnbull knows that. Greg Hunt wrote a thesis about it, and every serious economist out there supports the notion that if you're going to act, a market-based mechanism is the way to do it. a direct action policy that's being put forward by the Liberal Party is not a serious contribution to this debate. We know that if you were to fully cost it, it would be extremely expensive, leaving a $30 billion hole in the budget. Taxpaying households paying $720 a year to fund that kind of direct action. Malcolm Turnbull got it right when he said that he couldn't cite any economists that agree with it, but really it was Ross Garner who billed the cat on the question of direct action when he said recently that direct action would have some rationale if we wanted to pretend to take action against climate change but not do too much. It is ironic, isn't it, that the Liberal Party, which is a party that supports the power of markets, that is about smaller governments, on this issue of profound change is out there arguing for a direct government intervention into the economy, which is essentially based on the government picking winners. Now, in terms of those who support market mechanisms, you've got GE, AGL, Linkfox, Fujitsu, BP, IKEA, the list goes on. The Business Council of Australia, the AI Group, have all supported the notion of a market mechanism. And again, if you look at those companies that I've mentioned in Geelong, each of Shell, Ford and Alcoa support a market mechanism as the principal basis for action, and they support the notion that there should be action. Now, in citing that, I don't presume to suggest what Ford, Alcoa or Shell will ultimately say about whatever proposition is put forward by the Labor Party and by the government. Clearly, there are very significant issues that each of these companies will want to progress with the government, and indeed they are. And there is an intense dialogue going on from the Minister, or from the Prime Minister and the Minister Greg Combe, down to members who represent areas such as I do, to make sure that the detail of these issues is gotten right for those companies. But as to the principle of whether we should act, there is unanimity, and as to the principle of the form of that action, there is unanimity around using a market-based mechanism. Now, the politics of this, and particularly the politics in relation to the fear of a price on carbon, has really played out in two respects. Firstly, there is a concern that has been put forward in relation to the cost of living. And I've heard Tony Abbott in the last 24 hours talk about the increased costs in our economy will be unimaginable. But of course, that's a ridiculous comment to make, because these are costs which are completely imaginable. Indeed, they are perfectly able to be modelled. Tony Abbott visited Sanitarium, where he said that the price of Weet-Bix would skyrocket. And yet, under the CPRS, when modelling is done on that, the increase associated with the CPRS model would have been 0.0006 of a cent on Weet-Bix. Tony Abbott went to a nappy manufacturer, where he said the same thing about the price of nappies. Well, if we were to take the CPRS as the basis, the increase that you would see on nappies as a result would be 0.00155 of a cent. He said that food and grocery bills would go up 5% if we had a figure of $26 a tonne, and yet Treasury, when you do the modelling on that based on the CPRS, puts that figure at more like 0.6 to 0.8% of an increase. The fact is that there are many other price rises in or shocks in our economy, such as what's going on in the Middle East, such as the disasters over the summer, such as the rise in the Australian dollar, which are going to have a much more profound impact on prices than the carbon price itself. But in a way, this is something of a hollow debate, because we are going to experience this from the 1st of July next year, and so people will be able to see that for themselves. But the second issue is around job security, and here the opposition leader has been out scaremongering as well. And can I just say that the hypocrisy of the Liberal Party in relation to picking car manufacturing as a focus for their campaigning is breathtaking. Of course, if the Liberal Party had their way, they would take $500 million out of the car manufacturing industry by taking it out of the Automotive Transformation Scheme. Liberal governments have never been friends of car manufacturing, and workers at places like Ford in Geelong absolutely not. But of course, action does need to be taken carefully, and that's why there is significant assistance being provided to emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries, and it's why the dialogue that I've described with industry is well underway. The real question here is what will be the consequences of failing to act? And there, the consequences for industry and industrial workers in Geelong, as I've said, would be devastating. And so in that respect, the carbon price is fundamentally a pro-job policy. Now, the conduct of the two political parties in this debate have been obviously the subject of much comment. There is criticism of the Labor Party for having changed its position, it is said, from prior to the election to after. But of course, the Labor Party has been supporting an ETS for a very long time. We supported it in opposition. We supported it in the 2007 election. We spent as much political capital on that issue in our first term of government as any other. And we went to the last election supporting an ETS, and now we are implementing an emissions trading scheme which would have, at the outset, a three-year fixed price. No one, I think, could seriously question the Labor Party's attitude to the issue of climate change and what needs to be done about it, either pre or post, either the 2007 or the 2010 election. The Liberal Party, on the other hand, is a party which is currently being led by a self-proclaimed weather vane on this issue. Tony the Believer has at times said, we believe climate change is real. Yes, we believe humans make a contribution towards climate change. But then Tony the Denier will say that the argument is absolute crap. Tony the Believer in markets has said that there is much to be said for an emissions trading scheme. It was, after all, the mechanism for emission reduction ultimately chosen by the Howard government. Tony the Socialist is out there saying what we need is environmental direct action. The truth is that the Liberal Party has been captured by climate change deniers. Rational thinkers like Greg Hunt and Malcolm Turnbull have been taken hostage by or become complicit with those who are denying the science. And the consequence of that is that the great Liberal Party has gone AWOL on this debate. And in doing so, they have done this country a great disservice, and they have done workers in Geelong who are at the pointy end of this debate an enormous disservice. This is a tough issue. We need every shoulder to the wheel on this issue. We need every brain switched on. And that half the political representation of this country is plunging their head in the sand is an act of desertion. As hard as this issue is, and as tough as this issue is, I think that my responsibility representing a place like Geelong is to engage in this issue as best I can, is to bring whatever intelligence I can to this debate, to think and then to act. And in my view, that's exactly what this government is doing. Thank you.
Many thanks, Richard Miles. So we now have Sophie Marabella.
Thank you very much, Jared, and it's good of Richard to be here. He's flying overseas tonight, so it's great to have a fellow Victorian here and a former sparring partner from our university days, of course. Far from having our head in the sand, we're actually out there at the pointy end with workers trying to stop a tax that's going to fundamentally change Australia's economy. Richard mentioned a couple of points. He talked about China. Well, let's look at the facts about China. Over the next 10 years, the net new capacity of coal-fired power will increase, will be 10 times our entire power generation. That's additional to what they have now. And what they have now is currently 14 times our entire power sector. We're not the worst emitters in the world. The US has the highest per capita rate of emissions. And regarding Weet-Bix, Richard, I was there. I was standing next to Tony. He was actually asked about the Weet-Bix thing and didn't say Weet-Bix was going to go up. It was important to visit a place like Sanitarium because it highlights the problem we are having with the food processing sector and the fact that we have now become, for the first time, net importers of food and groceries. I'm grateful to be given the opportunity to have this debate because I think members of Parliament should be subjected, not just standing up here imparting their wisdom, but actually being subjected to the questioning and the views of the electorate, whether it's their own electorate or the Australian electorate in general. And I don't think that there is enough of that. I'm grateful to be given the opportunity to talk about something that is close to my heart, rural and regional Australia. Sadly, it's not as edifying to be speaking about something like the carbon tax, because not only is it pointless, but it's actually going to, I believe, increase our emissions worldwide and cause extraordinary destruction on the Australian economy. This isn't a debate about the actual science. That's been settled. The coalition has had a very clear position, and there is a bipartisan position that there should be a 5% reduction in emissions on 1992 levels. We just don't think the best way of doing that is through a tax. We believe in direct action, and contrary to what Richard said, there are economists who do believe it's a better way to go, including three Nobel laureates. We believe that we should have investment in more trees, better soils and smarter technology, and through that we will be able to reduce our emissions up to the 5% agreed level. For many Australians, even including those in regional areas, this is a particularly challenging time. And it's important to paint the landscape against which rural and regional communities are now looking to the future and trying to answer some questions. Costs of living are on an upward trajectory. Many people are still not only recovering from devastating floods, cyclones and bushfires, but also before that from one of the worst droughts in Australia's modern history. The drought was estimated to have reduced farmers' equivalent household income by something in the order of $20,000 annually, and it also had a significant impact on the mental and physical health on many rural and regional people, affected family relationships, and also had a devastating impact on the increase in suicide rates. Australia has also plunged its way back into a public debt and deficit spiral that has seen us just record our second largest budget deficit since the Second World War. That deficit has now soared to $49.4 billion, which is $8.6 billion worse than the forecast in last year's budget. And we're now seeing government borrowing $135 million a day. And the recent national accounts for the March quarter revealed the worst slump in economic growth in Australia since the days of the recession we had to have. Frankly, there's also now a complete lack of national leadership and direction from the current government, a mismanagement of state Labor governments, especially here in New South Wales. You do things on a big scale here in New South Wales. Has generated a series of problems with public infrastructure and has placed an enormous burden on local government for the delivery of basic services. And not surprisingly, amid this difficult combination of circumstances, I believe that many people are anxious about the future, including about their capacity to make ends meet, including about their capacity to invest in their business, in their farm. And in order to give a better indication about what I mean, it's worth pointing out some figures. Over the past 3.5 years, we've seen power prices go up by 44%, gas prices go up 29%, water prices go up 46%, education costs 17%, health costs 15%, rent up by 19%, and for those who are paying a mortgage, repayments have escalated by $500 a month. And those figures, I have to stress, are national figures. Regionally, they're worse because many of those costs tend to be higher in non-metropolitan areas. And I'd like to be able to give you those figures for regional areas, but the collection of that data ceased in late 2007. That was after the Labor Party came to office. And perhaps it would be good for us to ask the government, to ask Richard to take back the message, to see what can be done to restore the collection of statistics from non-metropolitan areas. Because that's the kind of information that I would have thought was pretty important in developing evidence-based policy for our regions. And even if we don't have all the information, to adopt a bit of a precautionary principle to make sure that we can look after our rural and regional areas. And we know, of course, that petrol and diesel prices are almost always more expensive in rural and regional areas, and in turn that almost always feeds its way through into high prices for other items as well. And of course, when you live in non-metropolitan areas, you tend to travel further, whether it's to go to work, whether it's to take your kids for netball or football matches on the weekend, or whether it's to try and access health facilities. Typically, rural and regional councils, particularly those who have a relatively small rate base as opposed to a large geographic area of responsibility, have a significantly lower capacity to raise revenue than their city counterparts. And these councils, the increased energy costs that they will face, they can't absorb, and we'll just have to put up rates, local government rates, which will be in turn a burden on their ratepayers. Australians who've lived off the land have faced multiple pressures over the last few years, whether it's increased regulation in areas like transport infrastructure and food security, or changes to rules surrounding livestock traceability, business structure adjustments and biosecurity requirements. Their overheads seem to be on the continual increase. A series of weather events across the country have also had a crushing impact. It's also worth bearing in mind that there is ever-increasing competition from foreign interests. This is a problem that was perhaps best encapsulated last year when, for the first time in living memory, we did become a net importer of food and groceries. And this issue is a burning issue out there in the community, particularly in rural and regional Australia. And the food and grocery manufacturing sector is actually the largest single component of Australia's manufacturing sector. Its international trade has been reduced from a $4.5 billion surplus in the 2004-05 year to a $1.8 billion deficit in the 2009-10 year. It's comprised of around 31,000 businesses that in 2009-10 spent about $3.5 billion a year in capital investment. And it's also employed more than 3% of all employed people in Australia. But as the Food and Grocery Council points out, it's facing a series of pressing challenges, including the increased cost of energy, availability of water, rising imports, and the rising Australian dollar's impacts on exports. Now, food production, food processing is linked into food security, and these issues are of critical importance, not only to those who think nationally about what's in Australia's best interest, what sort of country do we want to live in by 2050, but particularly pertinent to those communities who produce the nation's food, and often who provide the employment for significant food processing plants. And what's happening in the current environment, particularly with the concerns about what a carbon tax would do to increase production costs, it means that a lot of investment is not taking place now. Investment that's required to ensure that employment is secure for the next 5 to 10 years isn't occurring now. So if a carbon tax is introduced, you may not see all manufacturing jobs disappear overnight. What you will see is a lack of investment to upgrade plant facilities so that there is a natural decrease. And there are investment decisions that are not being made now out of a fear of what a carbon tax will do to the competitiveness of these particular manufacturing and processing plants. I'm sure many of you will recall the recent story about the reduction of Australian jobs at Heinz, and probably others reporting comments from the sector and from unions about the enormous challenges that face Australian food processing at the moment. And I do share those concerns. On the one hand, there are growing concerns about food security and our ability to feed ourselves. Yet on the other hand, the government is sending significant signals that it will act to discourage production and reduce profitability in the sector. In manufacturing more generally, employee numbers have recently dwindled to just under the 1 million level for the first time since statistics were collected. Since the start of 2008, there have been almost 90,000 jobs lost in manufacturing in Australia, or to put it more simply, 555 jobs lost every week over that period. And I regret to say, if the picture I've just painted across manufacturing isn't bad enough, then the problems that are going to be confronted with the carbon tax only exacerbate some of these challenges. And it's the additional cost to manufacturing that is the cause of the problem. You ask most manufacturers from one end of the country to the other, and they will tell you they are already operating on very thin margins, on very narrow profit margins. They will tell you they cannot absorb yet another cost and remain competitive. And that is a very simple story. The government doesn't need to listen to the opposition. It doesn't need to listen to Tony Abbott or to me. All they need to do is speak to manufacturing businesses. It's not hard. Let's assume for a moment, in the continued absence of any certainty from the government about a carbon tax, that they'll implement their tax at a starting price, and I guess it's a reasonable price to select, of $26 a tonne. That's a reasonable baseline figure, given that's what they're advocating under the CPRS. And this is a starting point, of course, which is expected to increase. It's worth remembering, though, that the Greens rejected the CPRS specifically because the carbon price wasn't high enough. So in any case, even if it does start at that relatively low level compared to what the Greens want, I'm sure it will increase. And it was the Food and Grocery Council that came up with a figure that food and grocery prices would rise from between 3 and 5%. And I have to tell you one thing. After many years of wall-to-wall Labor governments at the state and federal level, business is rather reluctant to come out and criticise Labor governments. There's a particular corporate culture that developed, shall we say, of cooperation and many, what I would say, unsavoury discussions at the other end of the phone from displeased ministers. So we've seen corporate compliance with certain government policies, and to have all of a sudden so many in the corporate sector come up, rise up and speak against this corporate tax is quite significant. They're not doing it as a favour to the coalition. They're not doing it because they don't have anything better to do. They're doing it because they are really going to hurt. And they still believe that their voice can make a difference. And I hope that it can. Axis Economics says it would close 16 coal mines and cost at least 10,000 jobs in coal mining. It would cost 24,000 jobs in mining, according to the ACIL. And the Minerals Council fears the carbon tax scheme's design could cost the industry $30 billion to 2020 and threaten an investment pipeline of $140 billion. And needless to say, of course, mining is concentrated in rural and remote areas. And it would cost 45,000 jobs in emissions-intensive industries, according to Frontier Economics. The sort of emissions-intensive industries like steel at Port Kembla, like cement at Port Adelaide, and aluminium industry at Portland. At a time when Australians are being told to embrace an increasingly open and globalised world, what we're seeing here is a reverse tariff that's intended to be imposed on Australian manufacturing. Let me tell you, country people think about these issues because they've always had to fight to retain services, always had to fight to be recognised as an important part of the Australian economy. And what they don't like to see is their government making decisions that penalises them to the advantage of foreign companies. So this carbon tax is a reverse tariff because it will mean import competition will not have an increased cost applied to its products because our competitors do not impose a carbon tax. And it's good to think that we are still a positive nation who believes that our government makes decisions in our interest. And that is why there is so much anger and lack of understanding of why the government isn't listening to the concerns that people have, particularly in rural and regional Australia, about a carbon tax. The National Farmers Federation has also done a bit of work. They've begun modelling the impact of the carbon tax on rice, sugar, cotton, pork and dairy, and they've already released an analysis showing that at $36 a tonne, farmers would be hit with an additional $36,000 a year in operating costs under the carbon tax. And if you look at just one local example in a rural and regional electorate in Victoria, that in McEwen, and take one municipality, Murrindindi, which is covered in that report, that shows that just for grain farming alone, annual business cost increases are projected to rise between 2.4 and 5.7%, with a reduction in net farm income of between 8.6 and 29.7% relative to a business as usual scenario. But what have we seen from those few Labor members who represent rural and regional electorates? Absolute silence. Absolute silence. The Prime Minister was asked in question time, what representations have you had from your members who represent rural and regional concerns and those electorates that have significant manufacturing in their electorates? And the Prime Minister did everything but answer the question. Because the truth is, it appears that not one local member has taken the concerns of their workforce to the Prime Minister. Not a peep out of them. And they are doing their own electorates a disservice, because if you, to steal one of the phrases you use, Richard, to stick your head in the sand and block your ears and not listen to the concerns of working Australians, that's going to end in tears. And I would recommend to my colleagues who sit on the government benches to stop being what Dougie Cameron called the lobotomised zombies, to actually stand up and say, the Emperor's got no clothes, this carbon tax is a dud, it's killing our base, it's going to kill manufacturing and alter the Australian economy, we can't just crash or crash through, we've got to stop this in its tracks. And I know some of them do say that privately, but they've got to have the courage. What is the point? What is the point of giving up a private life and all the other advantages that come from anonymity and not being in Parliament if you don't use the position you have when you take that bit of green leather or red leather? Why don't you use it? And I'm asking them on this one occasion to actually stand up and speak on behalf of their members, just as the workers at Port Kembla forced Paul Howes into a corner so that he would say that he wouldn't support a carbon tax if a single job was lost in the steel industry. I call on those Labor members, many of whom were put in there by the blue-collar workers in various unions from around the nation, to stand up for them. My electorate also has significant cattle interests. And I've looked at some of the figures. The Sheep Meat Council of Australia has also found that an impact that on that industry would be that a 16% loss in business revenue if we saw a carbon tax in the vicinity of $35. The impacts are going to be very widespread, whether it's in agriculture, whether it's in food processing or manufacturing based in rural and regional areas or the cities. There are going to be significant imposts on business costs. And it's not just about electricity costs in businesses. It's electricity costs in schools, aged care homes, the cool rooms on cherry farms, abattoirs and the like. And not only about the extra logistical and fuel costs typically associated with transporting livestock and machinery over long distances. What we're talking about is much wider ramifications than that, because we're talking about significant falls in business revenue and profitability, and as a result, the number of jobs that would be shed. We're also talking about a cumulative tax, a tax that will be a tax on a tax on a tax. When you look at a particular manufactured component, there'll be tax on each of one of those components, and it's very difficult, impossible, for the government to provide compensation for that. Already Graham Cray from BlueScope Steel has said, this is for an emissions-intensive industry, that any form of compensation would be akin to putting a band-aid over a bullet wound. And you can imagine for businesses that will get no compensation, like the local dry cleaning business or the local abattoir, the impact on them will be just as severe. In fact, Access Economics and Frontier Economics say respectively that for every job lost in cities under a carbon tax, 1.3 will be lost in the regions, and that there'll be more than a 4% fall in employment in non-urban areas. And in turn, that means we're talking about some very serious implications for rural and regional communities, because it's heartbreaking losing a job wherever you are. But when you're based in the city, you have a smaller area and a much larger catchment of potential employers to seek employment from. But when you live in the regions, the potential of alternative jobs isn't as large. The distance and the cost of travel is more significant, and often may involve significant geographic shifts, which causes a lot of displacement in a lot of communities. So more broadly, the repercussions of job losses in regions are generally more widely felt, and that's why there is a lot of concern out there in rural and regional areas and anxiety about a potential carbon tax. The linkages between businesses and workers are often much more direct and interdependent, and difficulties that are experienced in one business can very quickly spread to many supporting businesses and very quickly affect a whole town. And where the worst effects of a closure of a major employer can often be absorbed in urban areas, there's such a ripple effect in rural and regional areas that causes extraordinary distress. And I'll just give you an example. When you lose a few workers from a factory, they'll go. A few children will be taken out of the local school. They'll get a couple of fewer teachers because the children have left, and it has an absolutely spiralling effect. I've been given the wind-up, so I'll finish up by something that's fairly obvious. Let's be brutally honest. The carbon tax isn't going to save the planet. It was never intended to. It was concocted in a backroom deal to keep the Labor Party in power at the expense of Australian jobs, and even with the risk of increasing costs of living. For the Labor Party, politics has always been a numbers game. It's about getting the numbers within the union, within the faction, within the sub-faction. The numbers game and the culture of nepotism, of looking after your own, so disgracefully illustrated in New South Wales, means that that overrides a binding responsibility that they should have, that the Labor Party should have when they gain office, to govern for all Australians. Remember a leaked report about Julia Gillard not wanting to give pensioners a pay rise because she believed that they didn't vote for the Labor Party, but more of them voted for the Coalition. Well, she probably thinks that most people in rural and regional Australia vote for the Coalition as well and don't support the Labor Party. So this ruthless Labor Party approach means that why would you bother to adopt policies that facilitate the growth and survival in the regions?
Thank you, we're right on.
Okay. Anyone and everyone is indispensable in the quest to cling on to power on this issue, whether you're a blue-collar worker or a resident in a rural and regional area.
Thank you. Well, thanks to our two speakers. They're right on 25 minutes each, so thanks for that. We've had a bit of disagreement tonight, so I've got to be fair to both our speakers, so we'll manage that. It's not a formal debate, it's a discussion, so we'll have a period of questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than 7. Could I also just say thanks to Cause Chambers and Westgarth for the use of this facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion. Let us lead off I just want some brief responses. Both, I think if you both stand up here, then we can, one on either side, be the best way to handle it. I mean, Sophie Mirabella, obviously in your party, you've got demands from Malcolm Turnbull, which you probably can't match. And Richard Marles, in your, not in your party, but in the agreement you have with the Greens as part of the deal of the Gillard government coming to office after the election, you're going to have some demands from certainly sections of the Greens that are going to be difficult to accommodate. So how are you going to accommodate the differences within your party and the differences within your agreement? So I think perhaps if Richard leads off first, just some brief responses, then we'll go down to the rest. Okay.
Well, firstly, it's a fair question, and I think that you know, it's no easy task to reach an agreement. And you know, obviously, we're working down the path of getting one, but we haven't got there yet, and that by definition means that it's not certain. But I suppose I'd make a couple of points about it. I think it is. Well, firstly, we will, whatever is put in place is, from the Labor Party point of view, going to take into account the needs of industry in making sure that there is a smooth transition into putting a price on carbon. The kind of industry assistance which was described in the CPRS, I think, is fundamental to the proposition that is being put forward by Labor. I think for the Greens now to walk away from that in circumstances where they have put forward a view that they support action on climate change and they support action in the broad architecture of what we're doing is a very difficult choice for them to make indeed. But, you know, there is obviously going to be some difficult discussions ahead. But, you know, as I understand it, in the multi-party Committee on Climate Change, those discussions are being had. They're being had, with good grace and good nature. And I do think at the end of the day an agreement will be reached.
Thank you. So the quick response?
Quick response. Politics is about compromise. You can't get your own way 100% of the time. But it's who you decide to compromise with. And we're certainly not going to be compromising our position with the Loopy Greens. We are unashamedly a mainstream party. We are a broad church. There is shadow cabinet solidarity and party room solidarity. And within those confines, we come to our decisions.
Okay, so we're going to be brief. Okay.
Question to both speakers.
Just speak up a bit.
Question to both speakers. What's your attitude to the direct action tax incentives given by both parties to mine and burn carbon for depreciation cash flows to replace all mines and burn carbon machinery over 10 years? Would you agree that those tax incentives should only be available on condition that the cash is being invested in renewables?
Question about the cash incentives. I guess it's more direct action incentive. I guess it's more of Sophie Mirabella's question.
Oh, no, it's inconsistent inconsistent and hypocritical for them to have a price on carbon without still having the tax incentive.
Okay, so we'll accommodate both of you. Quick response.
Well,
so
if the question is to dictate how that funding should be spent, how those tax savings should be spent, well, I don't think it's the role of government to dictate how taxpayers' saved funds should be spent. We are unashamedly direct action advocates, and we will pursue those.
Brett. Well, I think whatever the details end up being, I think the basic mechanism that Labor's putting in place to, you know, facilitate a change in our economy is through a market mechanism. And, yes, there are some compensations being built into things to try and ease the transition, but the fundamental thing is through a market mechanism so that it's a market itself which is making the decisions about how best to reduce carbon or CO2 emissions for any particular business.
Sometimes we miss some of the answers that we can give to certain problems. In this paper this morning, I've written these small company Silex, who make photovoltaic cells in Australia, and they have a project with uranium. Now, this is an amazing issue, but this is just one example of how we could perhaps address the issue. They have a policy, they're working on a process where they can enrich the uranium. What I'm saying is that the sources of energy that are available, and even in Australia we have a large supply of uranium oxide, but it's such an evasive issue, we're not focusing on perhaps looking at the alternative. This is where the Liberal Party also is.
So you're suggesting we should do more on uranium?
We should be looking at other end. Okay. Yes. Just one.
Should nuclear be on the table?
Well, nuclear be on the table. Well, it's been well summarised.
We are looking at other angles. That's why we believe in harnessing smarter technology and new technology. We're unashamed about that, and we will continue to do that. The Labor Party refuses to accept the reduction in CO2 emissions through positive action in any area.
I think. I mean, nuclear is not on the table in Australia at the moment, certainly from the point of view of the ALP, because of the obvious issues associated with nuclear, but also because the path the duration of the path it would take to get to nuclear is so long, and given that we have such potential for renewables in this country, it makes sense at this point to be pursuing the option of renewables rather than nuclear, and that's really why the focus has been there.
My point was
that,
okay, exactly. Yeah, okay, down the back.
Yeah. Look, since you're both from Victoria,
just speak up a bit.
A long way back. Could you both explain to me what's going to happen to Latrobe Valley? So I know we haven't got the final draft at all, but as I understand it from top merchant bankers and from those who know a bit about the industry, Latrobe Valley in Victoria is under serious threat through huge changes to the way in which we transfer to carbon neutral economy, or whatever we want to call it, all the jargon floating around. Just what is the scenario for the Latrobe Valley? I mean, do they need special compensation? What, both of you tell me, what are we going to do about Latrobe Valley?
Question about
a huge source of energy for Victoria, and some people say it's going to be cactus.
Question about brown coal in the Latrobe Valley.
Well, there has been, under the CPRS, there were propositions of exactly that, special compensation for brown coal producers and coal producers.
Can you speak up?
Sorry. Under the CPRS, there was exactly that proposition of special compensation for coal producers and electricity producers. This is the time frames that we are talking about are long. That is the first point to make. I think if you are looking over a long time frame, I think gas is inevitably going to play an increasing role in relation to our energy needs. But, you know, who knows what over a long period of time might evolve in terms of technology which allows the emissions to be dealt with. Carbon capture and storage, for example, is something which is being...
Well, the
community of the Latrobe Valley flows from the future of those of that coal production. I mean, that's what you're saying, and that's why. So sure, I mean, I'm very well. I absolutely concede the connection of communities to industry. I live in a community that's totally connected to its industry. But if the fundamental question is about the future of that industry, I think that's the answer.
Very well.
A carbon tax is intended to punish coal-fired power generation, and Victoria particularly will suffer disproportionately, and as will those communities. That's what our campaign to fight this carbon tax is about. There's been no regard for those communities, for employment in those communities, and you're right, a carbon tax is going to destroy the Latrobe Valley.
So we're talking about what? Your lawn?
Yes.
Your lawn.
It's bigger than
your lawn.
It's huge.
Churchill. Okay, so for those who don't know the Latrobe Valley, there's a question there. Yeah.
Richard, welcome to balmy Sydney. I lived in Corio for a number of years, so I noticed that you've got a science degree, and I wanted to ask you about climate change. From the science of climate change, and you spent half of your address or so on the science. And the question is for you personally, not for the party, but is there evidence, scientific evidence, which you can foresee would cause you to change your mind about the science of climate change, and what would it be?
Well,
I'm not talking here about advice from government bodies which are, you know, prognosticating about science. I'm asking you about the science. What scientific evidence could you see that could cause you to change your mind about the science?
Well, Well, I put three propositions. One is fact, you know, sort of scientific measured fact, which is the level of CO2 in the atmosphere. That's not going to change. That's an observed fact. The second is people modelling the impact on that. Now, you model from the point of view of the best state of knowledge that we have about the systems that operate on our planet. You know, if there's someone comes up with a model in the future which contradicts the others, that would obviously be significant. But I mean, no one has remotely come close to that. And the vast, you know, there is a consensus in the models around what CO2 means in our atmosphere. And the third thing is that, you know, as I said, we are getting observed phenomena which are consistent with those models. You've got a model which is a model, but we're now starting to see observed outcomes which are consistent with it. Now, all of that has got, and it flows from something we know, which is that CO2 levels are at a high that hasn't been there for a million years. That's why you don't find a serious scientist out there who says anything other than the science is in. CSIRO, NASA, wherever you want to go, they will all say the science is happening. Oil companies are saying it, who have a total stake in this. I mean, that booklet that I described that I mentioned from Shell, it reads like, you know, An Inconvenient Truth from Al Gore, and it's written by Shell. And the reason they've written it is because they want, is because they follow this as closely as anyone, because they've got a vested interest in it, and they want stable public policy, and they don't want the uncertainty of not dealing with this issue now.
I will say what you find interesting, the US Met Office said that, in fact, the reason for all the tornadoes in the Midwest was because the Pacific Ocean was cooling. I found probably peculiar, but my real question...
Can you speak up for your question here?
Yeah, my real question was, well, market mechanisms, if you create an artificial market, the real problem is unwinding it later on if you see it's wrong. And that's what I was... You talk about it, of course, because you create a market in something, and then it goes wrong. Well, you'll have every merchant...
The question is, if you create a market and it goes wrong, you can't unwind it.
And the foundation of that question is, what if the science is wrong? But the fact of the matter is, you know, it is pretty simple. No one is questioning the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. No one is. Everybody who models this, who's an expert in it, is predicting things which are now occurring. That has got to be the cause of action. Because the other way around is that we decide, well, we won't do anything about it, and who knows what happens at that point.
Well, the question is, market, you can unwind direct action. That's what China's doing, for example. It's not creating a market.
Well, that's not right. I mean, China are looking at trialling market-based mechanisms, as I mentioned, in 12 or 13 of their districts. So they're absolutely looking at that.
Do you want to comment on that? You don't have to. Yeah.
All right, I won't. we'll give someone else a question.
Obviously, the Liberal Party is a bit more flexible with what members can think, say, and do.
I like to think so, yes.
Now, it would seem to me that in terms of this issue, we've certainly got the Greens accepting it, but we've got the ALP accepting it, we've got a proportion of Liberals accepting it. Why don't you give your Liberal members the conscience vote to consider their view on carbon tax?
Suggestion the Liberals should have a conscience vote on the carbon tax.
Well, I don't think that's appropriate, and I think it's silly because because we all come to an agreed position. That's what political parties are about. You discuss issues behind closed doors, you come to an agreed compromised position. And I don't think it works if you start then acting as independents and having a conscience vote on everything. I think you've seen the state of Australian federal politics when you have that approach giving disproportionate power to independents. Look, I don't get my way on issues in the party room or in shadow cabinet, but I have to cop it. And that's the system of our parliamentary democracy, and I think it works extremely well. People aren't muzzled in the Liberal Party. You're not excommunicated if you have a different point of view and you say so publicly. You can say that view, and you can say it in the party room, you can say it in the media. It happens all the time. But we're not going to have a conscience vote on policy issues.
Right. So,
Yeah, there's one here and then there's one here. Yep.
My question is
original.
If this room were full of dissenting scientists and me, contrary to your view that no serious scientists disagrees with you, including Richard Lindz and professors from physics from Princeton University, would you use derogatory terms such as flat earthers and head in the sand for those gentlemen that are sitting in here, or are those descriptors used just for political stunts? Because there are serious scientists who don't agree. You can disagree with them, but I think to make that assertion is false.
Illy is about the reference to flat earthers that head in the sanders.
Yes.
And deniers, I guess. So would you say that if you in front of a scientist who disagreed with you?
Well, I probably would. I mean, there were eminent scientists who didn't agree with Galileo that the Earth revolved around the Sun. There were eminent scientists who didn't think the world was round. But it's true. Well, it is true.
I don't want to lose control of this. I mean, Galileo never addressed the Sydney Institute. It was a long time ago.
The point I'm making is that there is a preponderance of view, and it's not about. In terms of acting on public policy, the question that must be asked is one around the precautionary principle. And in relation to that question, it was answered decades ago. And there isn't a serious question about that. Now, that might be that you might be somebody who thinks, I'm not sure this is going to happen. And there may be reasons around that. But given all that's out there, from the point of view of what we do now, it is clear.
Look, a precautionary principle doesn't mean you have to impose a great big new tax on everything we do. A precautionary principle would say, okay, let's spend taxpayers' dollars, do something positive for the environment, renew our soils, plant more trees, do things that have a dual impact, reducing CO2 emissions but also have a positive impact for the environment, which is what we're doing. But to be fair to Richard, I don't think he'd be as harsh as harsh on a room full of scientists as he is to a room full of his opponents, and that's understandably so. That's our political system. But I think he'd be a bit more respectful, wouldn't he, Richard? I think he would be.
Yeah, they got on well together at Melbourne University all those years ago.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask Richard. Doesn't it seem that to the Labor Party that everybody's fed up with taxes? It just seems that at every opportunity, politicians are just imposing more taxes.
Well, of course, the tax burden within our economy has decreased since 2007. Well, it has. I mean, the amount of income tax that people are paying is much less now than it was when we came to power. And the taxes that people are talking about in terms of, the flood levy, which will be in place for a short period of time, in terms of the minerals resource rent tax, which will be paid by companies that are doing very well, and we're talking about them paying the same proportion of tax that they would have paid a decade or two ago, and in relation to a carbon price, we're talking about a price which would be paid by only 1,000 entities within Australia, being the 1,000 that pay that emit the greatest amount of CO2. If you want to argue this in the context of who's taxing more and who's taxing less, and you want to reduce it to something as simple as that, we've already won.
But doesn't the tax fly, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, in short, yes, and what is being put forward, and what was put forward under the CPRS, and what we've said in relation to this, is that half of the money raised from that will be provided in compensation to lower middle income earners, so they are no worse off in relation to any increase, flow-on increases in prices that they experience. But look, this is going to be experienced. The kind of scare campaign that we're seeing at the moment of the sky's going to fall in and prices are going to go through the roof, I'd be very surprised if that is an issue at the next election.
Richard's mentioned scare campaign. I just need to make a particular comment. During the last election, I and the Coalition were criticised for. Richard said that our cut to the Green Car Innovation Fund was going to destroy the car industry in Geelong, and that their one of their new programs under the Green Car Innovation Fund was going to end. Richard knew that what we said was, yes, we would cut the fund, but that all existing contracts would be renewed. That was a scare campaign. The GST was a scare campaign. But what's worse is, when you take the high moral ground, accuse a political party of doing something when you know they're not, and then when you get into government 5 months later, cut the fund altogether. That's a dishonest scare campaign. So raising questions and providing alternatives to reduce emissions is not a scare campaign. Listening to blue-collar workers, manufacturing workers, SMEs in manufacturing that are the innovation foundation for Australian manufacturing, listening to their concerns and representing them is not a scare campaign. It's called political representation.
I think we might... I'm just going to conclude with a final question, because we're talking about regional Australia and how did we start? We started with Richard, so we'll end with Richard. So I'll start with Sophie. You're from Wangaratta, essentially. Your electorate's in Wangaratta, and you're telling us that there's great opposition in rural Victoria as part of rural Australia to a carbon tax leading to an emission trading scheme, because you go around your electorate. And Richard Miles, you're based in Geelong, which is a rural centre in important rural centre, regional centre of Victoria, and you're telling us that you go around your electorate and you reckon that the people in your electorate are on the side of carbon tax leading to emission trading scheme. So probably one of you is wrong. So how do you defend your position? Maybe not. You might end up.
Well, you know what? All you have to do is ask the workers in those factories. I've actually been to Geelong as well, and I've been to Greg Combey's electorate, and I've been in the Hunter. I've been from one end of Australia to the other, visiting manufacturing facilities, whether they're large, whether they're SMEs, and I do it on a weekly basis. Tomorrow I'm doing it in Melbourne. And so I'm repeating what people are telling me. And all I'm asking is for Greg Combey and Julia Gillard to have the courage to go and visit these facilities, to front up to these businesses, ask them behind closed doors what their profit margins are, ask them how a carbon tax will affect their profitability, ask them what they're going to do, and then you'll get the real answer. Don't believe us, believe the people in the real world who've put real dollars investing in their businesses that are concerned about a carbon tax.
Well, the first thing is it's not necessarily inconsistent, Jared, in that Wangaratta elects Sophie and Geelong elects me, and presumably there is a reason
that
for that. I would be concerned if people thought that we weren't going around and talking to businesses and talking to workers in these plants. Of course we are, and you'll see Greg has been making speeches in the Latrobe Valley and in the Hunter Valley recently, and for my part, I've met workers at Shell, at Blue Circle Cement, at Alcoa. Recently, I did a lunchtime session with a number of the delegates, about 20 or 30 delegates at the Alcoa lunchroom, and an aluminium smelter is a significant indirect emitter in that they're a huge consumer of electricity. The first thing that really comes through from that is that the level of knowledge about this is deep. From working people, they are following this issue, at least in Geelong, and it doesn't surprise me, because my first proposition was that this is an issue on both sides which is felt very deeply and intensely within Geelong. But I think people and of course there is a sense of if there is going to be a change to the economy, how is that going to affect our car and what does that mean for us? But I think people are also very, very alive to what's going on in the rest of the world. There is a deep concern about our industry being left behind, and I feel that enormously in the conversations that I have and what I hear from people. And what the overriding thing that comes from that workforce is they want a company and a workplace which is sustainable decades into the future. And that's only going to be delivered if we are able to wean our economy off its dependency on carbon.
Okay, many thanks. Look, that's been a very informative discussion.
You had two youngish politicians, both from rural or regional Australia, talking through an important issue. And you've only got to watch how political leaders travel. A lot of them are spending a lot of time in regional and rural Australia discussing this very issue. So that's why we're here tonight. We're very grateful that both Richard Miles and Sophie Mirabella came up from Victoria to talk to us tonight. It'll be on our podcast tomorrow. The papers will be published in due course in the Sydney Papers online, and APAC Channel 648 from Foxtel and Austar is here as well. So in conclusion, my only comment really is to say thanks for what's been a significant discussion and an informative night at the Sydney Institute. So well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.